Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a little bit of a reprise. We're bringing back a guest that we had less than 2 months ago. His name is Hector Garcia. He's a clinical psychologist that's working for the Veterans Administration down in San Antonio in East Texas. Well, maybe that's Central Texas. It depends where you're looking from. And last time he was on the program talking about his experiences and his ideas as a clinical psychologist looking into evolutionary psychology and trying to put in perspective some of the world's major religions and how they sort of come back to very primitive man on how the churches are set up today. Well, that was a great program. We got a lot of feedback. But today I want to talk to Hector about his day job, and that is working for the Veterans Administration, dealing with PTSD, that is post-traumatic stress disorder. And so welcome back to Science Studio, Hector.
So great to be here with you again, Keith.
Before we get into PTSD and all the ramifications, just run through quickly your background again so people can remind themselves of, you know, what you were and how you've got to where you are.
Well, I am a clinical psychologist, and I went to undergrad at UTEP, and from there went to Rutgers University and got my doctorate in clinical psychology, and there I've been practicing ever since.
So in these terms, once you've got your PhD in clinical psychology, then there are lots of job openings. That's the implication. You don't have to do postdocs and things like that that scientists in chemistry, biology, physics often have to do.
So there are post-clinical postdocs, but you're right, you're not just limited to academic positions. There are clinicians who go into academic positions, but there's also the clinical world that opens up to you in terms of employment. Yes, that is absolutely correct.
So in fact, you actually can get straight out there and start helping people straight away.
You can get out there and start helping people straight away, person by person, correct.
So how did you choose your career in terms of the day job working at the VA? Were there other ideas that you had of clinical psychology, of setting up your shingle some town and going from there? Or was it always that you had some understanding to go into a larger organization with bigger problems, perhaps?
Well, personally, I had done an internship at a VA in New Jersey, and I just loved the population. I've always been interested in war studies, as you and I have talked about with our last talk. And I noticed that with psychologists, so non-prescribers, the biggest treatment gains you can make are with depression and anxiety. And at that time, you know, PTSD was in the category of an anxiety disorder. So, you know, it's working with PTSD sufferers, you see immense gains in treatment, which means immense decreases in symptomology.
You said you had an internship at the VA while you were in New Jersey. Is that part of the PhD program, or is that a separate issue?
That's standard course for clinical doctoral level programs. You have to go through a year of clinical internship where you're supervised and accrue hours and get experience and things like that. So, you know, taking a break from the actual coursework and going in there and working with people full time, that's what that entails.
And there are many opportunities for that then, I guess.
All around the country, absolutely.
And you chose to stay close by? You could have had a nice internship in Hawaii or somewhere like that?
Well, I being on the East Coast at Rutgers, I actually stayed on in New York City for a couple years. And then when I had about enough of that, I said, I'm coming back to Texas. And here I've been ever since.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of PTSD again, post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, that's a relatively new expression. I mean, my father was associated with the Second World War. My grandfather was associated with the First World War. And I think about as far as anything like this came, there was simply, especially for the First World War, the concept of shell shock. But I guess this is just now an extension of that when people came back from the front, the experiences they had, the noise they had, everything. It all fits under the umbrella then now of PTSD, or are there separate subsections?
Well, you're absolutely correct. Shell shock, and it all represents the same phenomena. But we didn't have a very good grasp on what PTSD was until recent decades. In fact, there wasn't even a formal diagnosis in the manual that we used to diagnose psychiatric disorders until as late as 1980. But the phenomenology goes way back, and there's even a book out there by Jonathan Shea called Achilles in Vietnam, who he goes back and looks at Homer's epic poems and the Iliad and looks at some of the heroic characters who are fighting wars in that epic and determines that, hey, you know, what Homer is describing sure sounds a lot like PTSD. So we know it at least goes back that far. And in fact, there's a really interesting theory put forward by an Australian evolutionary psychiatrist named Chris Cantor that PTSD goes way back to the days of our early human ancestors as a means to protect us, because it's in many ways comprised of survival instincts that helped us to navigate dangerous environments. So kind of a long way of saying, yes, it goes, this is something that goes way back.
Well, most people think of PTSD as sort of an issue that really does not permit the person that's suffering from this to carry on a day-to-day life experience normally. You know, I mean, it is a syndrome. It is a problem with them associating with day-to-day life. So how does this, I think you said Chris Cantor in Australia, how does he think that that was something that developed to facilitate our historic predecessors?
Well, to explain that, I think a short foray into what PTSD symptoms are is probably in order. It's broken down into four main areas. The first area is called re-experiencing. So those symptoms all entail the sufferer to re-experience the traumatic event in some way. Memories that pop into one's head, nightmares, or seeing some kind of reminder that brings it back, and not in a pleasant way. We're talking an adrenaline surge. We're talking the emotions feeling very raw and painful as if the event just happened, whereas it may have occurred decades ago. Avoidance, that's another symptom which involves avoiding your memories or avoiding places or situations that remind you of your experience. For a lot of my veteran patients, that's crowded places. Arousal is another area, so getting angry or irritated very easily, being on high alert, watching your surroundings, you know, going to a grocery store or shopping mall and watching everybody in there, thinking tactically what you'll do if somebody tries something. And finally, having negative cognitions, negative thought patterns that really reflect a kind of calibration that got stuck on the trauma or the traumatic environment, such as, oh, I can't trust anybody, I have to watch my back all the time, you know, I can't let anybody out of my sight, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I can see how some of these aspects, in fact, would protect people. You're being slightly more aware of your surroundings and, you know, watching your back, so to speak, as you put it. And so this gentleman, Chris Cantor, this is a new idea?
It's been around, oh, I forget when exactly he wrote a book about this. It's been a couple decades already, but relatively new. Really, our understanding of PTSD took off in the 80s and has been, you know, accumulating momentum ever since. But absolutely, the idea is that all these behaviors you see in PTSD are geared for survival in a dangerous environment. So getting angry at the drop of a hat. Well, if you're surrounded by danger, that can be advantageous. Like you mentioned, it might not be as advantageous if, you know, in a business environment or at school or with your family.
So how do you go about doing the treatment? Your day-to-day, you're working with vets. This is your career. This is your day-to-day activity. How do you go about doing it? And what are the, if I might call them, tricks of the trade? What is the treatment that is out there for people who suffer?
This is something that I really would like your listeners to know about. And, you know, the thing is, before the 1980s, 1990s, we didn't know anything about treating PTSD. There was no science or little science on PTSD. We didn't have a good understanding of what it was or how to treat it. But since then, large volumes of research have been produced looking at what works and what doesn't work. In the end, it's not so much talk therapy where you would come in and talk to your provider in an open-ended, unstructured way. The treatments that work best are training-oriented, essentially. So one treatment that I do a lot of is called prolonged exposure therapy. And I like to describe this as field training. So what we do is we design a set of exercises for people to do where they go out to public places, malls, restaurants, stores, and sit with their back to the door, things like that, over and over and over until their anxiety diminishes and they can just move about those kinds of spaces freely without any concern.
Well, hang on a minute. So the very first time that they have to do this, or the first few times, or the first many times, depending upon the patient, I suspect, are they accompanied by somebody, or are they simply relying on something that you've told them and said, just stick it out and it'll get easier?
It depends. For some people, having another person makes them feel a little bit more comforted. For some people, having other people makes them feel more vulnerable. Either way, we try to structure the exercises in a stepwise fashion so that you do exercises that are a little bit easier at first and work your way up, going to a department store when it's not very crowded until you habituate to that, and then working your way up to Walmart during rush hour kind of thing.
Does it make any difference where the impetus to be in the crowd makes a difference? So if, for example, you've got a vet that happens also to be a great, for want of a better team, Dallas Cowboy fan, so when he goes to a game that he's really interested in, does this problem still manifest itself as opposed to when he's in a large crowd which was unfocused as far as he was concerned?
That's a great question. Usually, it doesn't matter. Large crowds, even if it's like, you know, if it's like a professional sporting event or something like that, that really tends to bother people more so when it's strangers. So, you know, again, this goes back way far in our evolutionary history, where the biggest threats to life were rivaling groups of people. There's been research looking at foraging societies, for example, that found that up to 30% of men in foraging societies get killed by other groups of men or by individual men. That's huge.
I'm glad I don't forage anymore.
I am glad, too. That's a significant threat, and you can see how the threat of other people may have driven, you know, certain adaptations, including post-traumatic stress disorder, and the question you asked, being anxious in a big crowd.
So let's go to that concept of the danger. I mean, there are scenarios out there now that say, well, the world is changing so dramatically, the climate seems to be changing dramatically, water may become an issue, and people will, in fact, resort to some foraging, maybe as national groups. Do you ever think about those lines? The future of
absolutely.
Man.
Absolutely. I think environmentalists tend to neglect the ultimate driving force behind resource depletion and all the other environmental problems that we see today, and that's overpopulation.
Uh-huh.
Overpopulation tends to create competition for resources, and we humans, like other animals, tend to compete for those resources, and sometimes violently, and so that's a concern. What will happen when we reach the upper limits on sustainability?
So 30% will go straight away, according to your background.
Well, it's an open question.
Right.
Now, there has been research showing that society has actually been getting safer over time. Steven Pinker wrote a fascinating book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, which crunches huge amounts of data, ultimately finding that since those days as hunter-gatherers, when 30% of men might get killed off, things have been getting a lot better. It may not seem like that because the news tends to cover only the worst of humanity, but in fact, when you look at the data, we are getting more peaceable as a species.
Well, I'm sitting here in one of the safest cities in North America, in El Paso, according to the FBI anyway, and I understand that. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest this week is a reprise with Dr. Hector Garcia, working for the Veterans Administration in San Antonio, and we're talking about PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Most cancers of the pancreas are not discovered until people are in stage 3 or 4. Sadly, only 5% are alive 5 years after diagnosis.
A new test, though, could be a lifesaver if it proves to be effective in detecting the cancer early. The pancreas sits behind the stomach and helps regulate blood sugar and aids in digestion.
Doctors diagnose pancreatic cancer by imaging or doing a biopsy. By then, the cancer is usually spread to major blood vessels, lymph nodes, and other organs.
In the study, the new test uses just 1 microliter of blood, which is less than 1 drop of water. It was able to detect pancreatic cancer in more than 90% of those with the disease. It also did not falsely diagnose a group of healthy people and others with an inflamed pancreas.
The test measures small balloon-like structures that cells release into the bloodstream called extracellular vesicles. Pancreatic cancer cells release vesicles with a different protein on them than normal cells.
Scientists developed gold nanoparticles on a sensor chip that bind to these pancreatic cancer extracellular vesicles. This binding causes a change in the intensity and color of the light the nanoparticles emit.
The test was able to diagnose 7 patients with early-stage pancreatic cancer. Tested again after surgery to remove tumors, lower levels of the extracellular vesicles were detected.
More work needs to be done on the new test, but if successful, it could be the first major advance in pancreatic cancer detection, which is expected to be the second leading cause of cancer deaths within a decade.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Hector Garcia from the Veterans Administration down in San Antonio. And I've only ever been in big crowds twice. And I remember very vividly 2 distinct responses. They were both in India. One was at a religious site on the Ganges, just was full of people milling around, and I was milling around. I was walking, and I was participating in a funeral, as a matter of fact. But I'd never been so close to so many people. But I didn't feel any fear at all. I didn't feel any trepidation. But on the way back from there, I was in a car, and we went through a little town, Roorkee, well, it's not so little, and there's just millions of people on the streets, and we were in this car and going slowly, slower than some of the people walking, and strangers looking in the car. And then I felt uncomfortable. I really did. There's a difference between the control that you feel you have over yourself and the feeling of helplessness when you're sort of trapped. Are those sorts of feelings very common then with people who suffer from PTSD with real reasons as opposed to mine?
Absolutely. Feeling trapped. In fact, a lot of my veterans are continuously look for routes of egress whenever they go somewhere. What would be a good escape route? How would I protect myself or my family? How could I get out of here if something were to happen? Which, again, in a combat theater, that's immensely useful. In a peacetime civilian world, that creates all kinds of problems. The biggest one is you just don't enjoy life. You just don't enjoy yourself. If you go out to dinner with your family, how much of your attention is able to focus on the conversation and what you're there for as opposed to what's happening around you? And that's one of the biggest reasons.
So then, apart from the field training that you're talking about, just taking the patients and sort of putting them into an environment in a repetitive manner so they become used to it, rather like being on the radio, I must say, is that the only methodology, or do you have other methodologies of counseling and sitting down one-on-one, et cetera?
There are other methodologies. There's actually another component to the treatment that component belongs to, prolonged exposure, and that involves going over to the traumatic experience over and over and over until the person habituates to that experience. So in other words, what we do is we have the patient sit down and with some guidance narrate themselves in the first person their traumatic experience, record that on audio, say on their smartphone, and listen to that every day. And just like going out in public, at first the anxiety is pretty high, but eventually that memory just becomes like any other memory. You don't see a huge adrenal response to the content of the memory. The emotions no longer feel painful.
Are you monitoring these people as they're going through their story? That is there a photographic or a video that you can show back to show improvement that would presumably help the patient?
Not necessarily a video showing improvement, but we do have the patients rate their discomfort every time they hear the recording and chart that.
Then if you were to take that and have it in a different environment, do you always do it in the same place? The revisiting the experience, is it always in your office or in a clinic or are they in different locations and you find different responses because they're comfortable with one environment now, but not necessarily with the particular memories?
So the bulk of what happens in these treatments happens outside the therapy office. So we make recordings in the therapy session. The patient will take the recording home and listen to the memory over and over, and they habituate to the memory. But it's not necessary to listen to the memory in different environments to allow that to happen, because the memory is specific to itself. But the beauty of that is, by the time the patient has habituated to that memory, they'll get reminders of it, and instead of getting a huge memory surge, it's just like any other memory, and the person moves on instead of being continuously distracted by the surge in emotion that occurs before treatment.
Interesting. So these field trainings, is it sometimes useful to have a couple of patients that have gone through similar or the same experience together to work it out together, or is it always, in your case, one-to-one, you with the patient, as opposed to two, three patients that might reinforce each other's recovery?
That's a great question. Typically, it's done just one-on-one, I think, for practical reasons. There is research going on looking at whether or not you can do this as a group, but we're trying to get the veteran to habituate to things that were dangerous in the combat environment, but not dangerous in the current environment. So one of the things that veterans learn in theater is you don't go out without your buddies, right? That's dangerous. So what happens is they don't like to go out without their buddies when they're in civilian life. And their buddies are typically veterans who have a high degree of training, so they know what to do if something goes wrong. So you might guess if going out without their buddies makes them feel anxious, you might guess what we have them do as an exercise, right? They go out without their buddies or go out with people without military training.
Tell me about the role of the family. You know, a veteran who's come back from, say, Korea or Vietnam or Afghanistan or wherever, and most of those experiences are associated, obviously, with the war environment. But one of the most crucial interruptions of their normal life, I presume, is when they get these throwbacks or these conditions in the midst of their family. Do you often have to bring the family into the sessions or the field experiences?
That is a terrific question. We know that social support is critical to recovery from so many kinds of problems, including PTSD. And I personally like to see families, at least in the beginning part of treatment, just to hear what treatment is all about. Because I found that when families get involved, the treatment goes a lot better. Now, one of the things that happens is that veterans unwittingly train their families, so to speak, to help them avoid. And avoidance prevents recovery. If you never go out to the public place, you can never habituate to it. Your nervous system can never get used to it. So a lot of times, family members, it's kind of intuitive, you know, when you love somebody and something makes them feel uncomfortable, you're going to do it for them. You're going to say, no, don't worry about it, honey. I'll go to the store. You wait right here, right?
Yes.
Or a lot of times, my patients' children or grandchildren, they know where daddy likes to sit. He likes to sit there with his back against the wall. Well, guess what? When we start doing these treatments, that's going to have to change. So the spouse is going to have to say, no, you actually got to come with me to the grocery store this time, or no, you have to sit here with your back to the door. So family plays a critical role in so many ways, just in terms of emotional support and also the pragmatics of habituation, as the case may be with this treatment prolonged exposure therapy.
The returning warriors, we've got PTSD. How do you identify them? I mean, are there special, when people get checked out of the military, do they go through a particular test to show whether or not they are likely to suffer from PTSD? Or is it purely they self-analyze and find out they've got a problem and come to you? How does it work?
Well, it's a little of both. I think since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've been getting a lot better about diagnosing PTSD early, trying to place some stopgaps that captures symptoms before the person goes back and it wreaks havoc with their personal lives or professional lives.
But I mean, I must say it probably also happens while they're in the force, in the military. I mean, they've begun to get these symptoms. They just don't get it when they get released. So within the active military, there must be treatments. I didn't realize to ask the question. Do you mainly treat veterans, or because you're in the VA, or do you actually treat people who are actually active military?
The VA only treats veterans, people who have since separated from the military. But, you know, to answer your question, you know, the problem sometimes happens when in the process of separating from the military, veterans are asked, do you have this symptom? Do you have that symptom? And usually, or many times at least, they say no, because they don't want to do anything that delays their out processing. They just want to get home with their families and have a cold beer. They don't want to mess with it. It's later on when they start having problems that they take themselves to the VA, or very often it's their wives or their spouses that say, you know what, you better go get some help. That's what happens very commonly in the patients that I see.
And nowadays it's so well understood for someone like me to know what PTSD is. And so the society is more aware and the help is more forthcoming. Let me just finish up this session, because I one question I have in mind, it's not just Americans that go to war, all right? The British are out there, the Russians are doing what they do wherever they do it. I mean, this is a worldwide concept, is war, and so PTSD is also. Is there much of an international collaboration in your field?
There is a collaboration. There have been studies in Israel, in the UK, in Australia, in Italy, all over the world. And the treatments that we use at VA are the most studied treatments that there are. And again, mentioning these by name, one is called prolonged exposure therapy. And the other one, which we didn't have time to talk about, is called cognitive processing therapy. But these are what are known as evidence-based treatments, just like a medication. If you take a medication, that has been through research trials, and that's what you want. The same with psychological non-medication treatments. You want these to have gone through the rigor of scientific testing, and those treatments have internationally. So that's a good thing. We know they're effective. They work.
Is there much of a problem with taking pills for this and getting hooked on the pill and not getting cured?
Well, there are some kinds of medications that are contraindicated, and mostly it's benzodiazepines, which are Xanax and Valium, relaxants. The research is clear that relaxants, which whether benzodiazepines, alcohol, or marijuana, it prevents you from habituating.
So it's just a palliative, but it's not a cure.
Exactly. And once you get off of those meds, it comes back. So it's better that you go through the treatment not on relaxants.
Yep.
And at the end, you might not even want them anymore, because your arousal had been so reduced that you don't need to equalize it with relaxants.
Hector Garcia, clinical psychologist, Veterans Administration, San Antonio, ex-UT El Paso undergraduate. It's been great to have you on the radio. I've learned a lot. And you're doing some very valuable work, and I presume this is a whole career. You're not going to change just because you've written a successful book about religion. You're going to continue to work with our vets, I guess?
I love the work. It's very rewarding. I will say that.
Okay, lovely. And it's a rewarding program. We'd like to thank you for being on here. I want to thank Kimberly Garcia, no relative, for putting the program together. And we'll all be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.